Well, unless you've been living in a cave, which might not be a bad idea, the summer heat, you've probably noticed, is here, and our air conditioners are working harder than ever to keep us cool. I'm Jill Nadeau. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show on Wisconsin Public Radio. And back in the studio today are the weather guys. John Martin is a professor and former chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison, and Steve Ackerman is the former vice chancellor for research and graduate education at UW-Madison. Steve is also an emeritus professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And you know, when you guys are on, my muscles around my mouth get a lot of exercise because of that, having to say atmospheric and oceanic sciences. I appreciate that, right? What questions?
You can just say the weather guys.
The weather guys, everybody knows. What weather questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Thanks for joining us again, guys. We really do appreciate it.
It's great to be great here to on be this here. Hot day.
Oh, yes. It's still hot. But it looks like we're getting a little relief. Humidity is going to go down. That's the hard part, isn't it?
I think it's the worst part, actually. Mm-hmm. I mean, the air temperature itself is usually not the thing that catches my attention. It's the humidity. Yeah, right. Almost always.
Yeah, when you're like walking underwater, when you're walking across the street. Yeah. So, for sure.
Because your body can't cool down with the high humidity.
Right.
I was just going to ask. It's because it's evaporation kind of thing, right? Yeah. Well, how did last week's heat wave, which is continuing today, kind of reflect on the trends in here in Wisconsin? What's going on with the heat and humidity? And I know you all take care of looking at that. So
there's a steady global increase in both air temperature and humidity, the amount of water vapor in the air. But when you have a local regional heat wave, it's mostly a function of circumstances of that period of time. You know, it's not completely unrelated to what's going on in the background. That would be foolish to say that. But it would be almost as, probably more foolish to suggest that the fact we were 96 last Sunday with a dew point of 72 is de facto a function of global warming. Mid-June, we get that every once in a while here. And it's not surprising. We're not far from the Gulf of Mexico. There's a lot of water vapor that gets evaporated off that warm body of water. There's vegetation that's now starting to lose water by evapotranspiration at this point in its maturity. That all adds in to giving us the most humid part of the summer is from mid-June to about August 1. Mm-hmm. And, and then you get an occasional a situation in which you're very much warmer than normal, and they come along every once in a while. So, I'd say that.
What is a heat wave, Steve? I mean, how is that defined?
It's an interesting definition. I don't know if I'll get it exact, but it's along the lines of hot weather that's not abnormal, that is abnormal for that region, right? So what does that mean, right? Because what that means is what a heat wave is for Florida is different than what a heat wave is going to be for us up here.
Sure.
So one day they've been trying to track it is looking at, in terms of what's happening, what are the number of high temperature records and low temperature records that are being set.
Okay.
And so they're trying to look at what those are in trying to define a particular heat wave for a particular region.
Okay. Does it have to last a certain amount of time? And who makes that call? Does it matter?
I think there is a duration criteria.
There's got to be a duration, right? Because if it's, you know, it's like John is saying, if it gets up to be 96 degrees and then it's 70 the next day, that's not a heat wave.
There is a duration criteria. And I think that's also regionally dependent because, places down south, if you're 5 degrees over your average temperature, you might have easy to get 6 or 7 days in a row like that. Not so easy up here. And so I think in this region, it's 3 days or something like this. Okay. Seems to be ringing in my memory.
Three days
of a temperature, some threshold above the average for those days is it considered a heat wave or something like that.
Okay. All right. You guys wrote a column recently, and if no one has seen your column, where can they find it? Number one. John?
Oh, every Monday, Wisconsin State Journal. usually on page one, well, two through four, somewhere in there.
Two through four? That's sometimes a big article.
Sometimes it's on page two, sometimes it's on page four.
Okay.
Yeah, it's never more than 300 words. We get yelled at if we go more than 300 words. So.
Okay.
And if you don't get the paper, we publish it on SIMS, the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. If you look for the weather guys, SIMS, C-I-M-S-S.
C-I-M-S.
Yeah, there'll be a link that'll pop up to a calendar, and it has most of our articles for the past few years.
Yeah, I think if you even just put the weather guys, it'll pop up.
It'll pop up, yeah.
Yeah, it'll be one of those answers. Yeah.
And if you have a question, send it in.
Please do, would you?
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Because that's probably the hardest part of your day or your week is trying to figure out a topic. Right?
Well, it's trying to fit it in is difficult. You know, you got a lot of other things going on, and then you realize suddenly Steve will notify me on Thursday morning and goes, what do you think about this? And I go, damn it, he beat me to it again. How did he do that? I forgot it was Thursday.
Well, you know, he has a little more free time than you do these days. Just a little bit. So your title, or the title of your recent article was called, Is There Consensus on Global Warming?
Hmm.
Is there?
There is scientific consensus for sure. You know, scientists look, whether you're a meteorologist, biologist, oceanologist, it doesn't matter. You look at the evidence. You look
right.
at the data, and you look at the physics, chemistry, and things that go along with that. And I think the number is 99% of scientists recognize that global warming is real and it's being caused by burning of greenhouse gases,
mm-hmm.
which we do through our human activities.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely
yeah.
correct.
Yeah.
We don't wish.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I would like to have summers that weren't as hot as humid, but wishing that and hoping that isn't going to help.
No.
It's what the data is telling us, which is important.
For climate change deniers, I always wonder, why would there be a conspiracy of scientists who want to tell you that we're having global warming? Why?
One of the theories is, and who knows if it didn't have something to do with what went on in the first few months of this current administration, cutting budgets and whatnot. One of the theories is, well, all one has to do if you're an academic is write a proposal within which the word climate shows up. And you scare people, and suddenly you'll get a $2 million grant. First, nobody gets $2 million grants. The success rate on writing proposals, which all of us on this campus have to do in one way, shape, or form, not with respect to the climate, but something else, is on the order of 10 to 20%. So one in five, approximately, succeeds. And if you're at Wisconsin, because the scholarship and the group of scholars we collect here by our competitive interviewing process, it's probably more like 30% because we're better than the average place. Mm. And but even so, you're not any better than a 300 hitter on your proposals. There is absolutely nothing to the case that if you say climate in a proposal, you are, you know, running on some gravy train. It's mm-hmm. total nonsense. That's one of the arguments you hear over and over again. And I'm sure it's at the root of this waste, fraud, and abuse that Elon Musk thought he was finding mm-hmm. in the National Science Foundation and other places.
Sure. You have anything to add to that, Steve?
It's kind of interesting because, as John is pointing out, that's one reason. What's interesting now is that the current government, if you have climate in your organization, they're not funding you.
Yeah.
Right. So it's kind of flipped around to actually, and this is actually happening because we have the evidence that says that. You don't have the evidence to support the claim that if you deal with climate, you're going to get funded. But we do have the evidence because we know groups that are not being funded because they have climate in their word and they're being told that.
Yeah.
It's an
interesting time that we live in.
It is an interesting time.
It is an interesting time.
And I guess we're blessed with that, isn't that? May you live in interesting times, isn't there?
There's got to be an upside somewhere.
I guess I'd like to add the amendment, but in interesting times with other interested individuals.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so I think that's where we're failing
not
right
dismissive,
now.
Yeah.
Let's go to the phones. Vern in Boyd has a question or comment. Go ahead, Vern.
Oh, hi. Yeah, hi. Couple of things on climate. For one, in July 1936, from July 8th or 6th, we had 103 to 111 degrees, 104 degrees. It's been like almost 2 weeks. Okay? Now, in 1988, I did a thing on hurricanes. Okay? I sent it to Joe Biden 2022. And the interesting thing is, Hurricane Helene, 1988 was a heat wave, a massive heat wave broken up by a hurricane. 2024, Hurricane Helene. History repeats. How do you explain the Dust Bowl days? Okay? That's before we had all this carbon.
Okay.
Yeah. Well,
we moved here in 88, and I remember being Wisconsin was a hot, dry, in terms of precipitation, summer. Everything was brown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dust Bowl question's a good one. Yeah. There's climatic fluctuations going on in the background. There's also really bad agricultural practices that led to that. Constantly pulling up the native crops, which had long adapted to the sandy-type soils in the plains, and supplanting it with wheat and corn was a big mistake. It was not an intelligent move. And the consequence was the soil was already prone to erosion. And if you throw on top of that an unusually dry period in the mid-1930s, that's the recipe for disaster, and that's what happened. And it was easy to reclaim it. Things came back relatively quickly once there was some more, let's say, more discerning farming practices were brought back to the plains. Things recovered rather nicely.
Okay, thanks, Vern. Don in Iron River, go right ahead with your question.
Hello. Say, if I recall correctly, a couple years ago, you guys said you never heard of Rolling Thunder, but we had it up here Saturday.
So Rolling Thunder in terms of the sound of the thunder or in terms of the storm?
The sound of the thunder. Lasted over an hour and 10 minutes.
Just continuous, right?
Continuous, correct.
Yeah. I've heard it a couple of times myself. We might have not been familiar with the term. I think that both of us have probably experienced things that have gone on for, you know, tens of minutes, maybe even an hour, where there's thunderstorms. They might be training right to the adjacent to where you are, but not coming right over you so you don't get the lightning and the rain, but you might just hear this constant thunder. And I know that I've heard that more than once in my life, and it's awe-inspiring. I love it when it happens. Yeah. Did you happen to be in the middle of the rain, or just did you hear mostly the thunder?
Very little rain, heard the thunder, but it's really hard to sleep.
Yeah, I imagine so. Yeah, and I'll bet you 10 to 1 that you had a line of thunderstorms that was just moving from southwest to northeast, individual storms doing that as one guess, and they were just to your west or just to your east, and so they didn't make much eastward or westward progress, so that they were constant companions, but not right on top of you.
Great. Well, thanks for calling in, Don. I really appreciate that. We've had a lot of that recently, haven't we? It seems like the storms are just kind of like in little strips, and they may hit you, may not.
And we just had it yesterday in terms of Madison. They were just north
yeah,
of us.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
We had a little rain.
A little sprinkle. That's it.
Yeah, but you could see it was really nasty.
Yeah, very
north.
True. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep,
and in a line.
Yeah, in a line. It's kind of strange. We're joined today by John Martin, professor and former chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison, and Steve Ackerman, an emeritus professor of the same department. We like to call them the weather guys. It's just easier. Give us a call if you have a question for him. 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is a Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najo. We're talking to the weather guys today. And if you're interested in even more weather information, tomorrow on Wisconsin Today, they're going to talk a little bit more about the funding cuts for all the critical weather updates that we all rely on, and what could be at stake with that those cuts. So tune in at 9 or again in the evening at 7 o'clock. Yeah, 7 o'clock, thanks, Lee. I knew you'd know that. And you can catch that. Always something interesting on that show as well. But guys, let's go to an email that we got from Pete in Kaukauna. He wanted to know what a waterspout would look like on an inland lake. He was at Pine Lake, near Hiles, Wisconsin. On June 21st, about 8:15, some thunderstorms came through. The wind was out of the south, very strong wind. They watched when about halfway across the lake, water just started lifting from the surface, going 70 or 80 feet in the air, probably a strip about 100 yards long. And after a time, the water wall just collapsed. He also saw a small area of rotating water, a cyclone, for a few seconds when it was over. And he's never seen anything like it and would love your comments.
I'd love to have seen it.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. And it sounds just like he describes.
Yep.
It doesn't sound like a tornado that went over a lake. And waterspouts, They kind of start at the surface, the rotation, and then they get connected to a storm that's up above, like a storm moving in. It sort of sounds, in my mind, what he was seeing, because it just all collapsed, which means it got disconnected from the updraft and the storm, and all the water just fell out, probably.
I think he saw exactly what he's asking us to tell him, which is a water spout on an inland lake. I think that's exactly
that
what it was.
I wish we would have seen it.
Yeah, I know. I certainly wish.
Pete, where are the video?
And really good description of, you know, you can see the water rotating when the funnel disappears and all that. That would be all consistent with that.
Yeah, and I love the fact that he has the exact time and the date and where it was. Man. It's like, that's great observation work, Pete. Thank you.
You're never going to forget it, I bet.
Yeah. No, I'm sure he'll be telling that story for a long time. We did get it. Now, here's a question from Emily. She emailed, apparently they're looking to replace their roof soon. I know this kind of goes over into the home improvement area, but how should Emily take our changing climate into account as they decide on how best to do that?
I wouldn't pick a black roof. So I think the main thing, in addition to wanting to make sure that it's structured well, so that you're fighting the typical type of winds there or not, and losing shingles because of that.
Sure.
Is to be reflective and certainly not absorbent, and that'll be good for the home heating as well, instead of just heating up the roof.
What about in the wintertime, though?
Oh, in the wintertime.
It does snow here.
That's true. It does snow here. Yeah. But global warming occurs in the summer and in the winter. and part of that is, again, our winters are getting warmer pretty soon. I wouldn't say pretty soon. At some point, we may not have snowfall, and John will be extremely depressed.
I better be long gone by the time that comes. I will be very depressed with that. I don't know if that maybe... as secondary considerations, things that are a little more energy efficient. So, you know, you can relate. You can relate the maybe the urgency to acquire energy 30 years from now in a warmer climate could be a serious thing to consider in terms of what you do with your roof. If it's more energy efficient, you're making probably a good move for the future. But somewhat hard to describe all the implications, I guess.
Yeah. And Alice, why don't you call back with that question when we have one of our home improvement experts on? They probably have been getting questions, and they're certainly improving that kind of stuff. And that's the second Thursday of every month we have one of those gentlemen on with us.
And I bet the roofers have been looking at that too.
Yeah. Oh my gosh! Yes.
And then the insurance companies. Right. How am I going to replace a roof? What's going to be the request?
Yeah. Right, and that's the first thing I thought about. It's like, you know what? We're getting a lot more fires than we used to, too. So, what you're using makes a difference, too.
Sure does.
So it's a great question to ask because roofs are not cheap. So let's go to Maria in Madison. Go right ahead, Maria.
Oh, hi. This is so good. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to know, and I'm not denying the fact that there is a lot of pollution caused by us human beings, but is there something, is it possible that the universe is getting old? I don't know how else to ask that, but remember there was a Big Bang Theory, and, but is it possible for the universe, the planet, to get old? Or,
well, it's definitely getting older.
What comes to my mind, I just read an article about... there's a black hole and they're about to collide. Two black holes about to collide.
That's good, right?
But it's so far away. Maybe in astronomical terms, it's short, but in our terms, it's a long time. We are getting older. I mean, they just found, in fact, there's another article I read. I guess I must read a lot when I'm retired.
But
they just found the oldest rock up in Wisconsin.
Oh, in the Dells area, right?
Yeah, in the Dells area. Yeah. And that was 4-point-something billion years now. We know we're at least that old, and we are getting older, and hopefully we'll be around for another 4 billion years.
But
I don't think that aging has very little to do with how the atmospheric composition has changed in the last 150 years. So
that's true.
That's completely a function of what we've done to it. And so it seems we have a responsibility to figure out what to do about it now.
And our weather patterns do back and forth, right, over the billions of years, warm, cold, whatever. But this is increasing faster, right?
Yeah,
so that's
right.
The main thing that it's people have to understand.
It's the rate of change, exactly as you say, Jill, it's the rate of change over short periods of time that falls way outside the realm of the natural variability, which we have a reasonable measure of from other proxies of observations. So we're not in the dark about what the natural variability and the time scale of that is. Mm-hmm. And we know that in comparison, this is much more rapid and perfectly coincident with burning of fossil fuels.
Yeah.
It's hand to glove.
Yeah. Right.
The evidence is so clear.
Yes. Elizabeth and Poignet emailed to ask, are overnight low temperatures trending higher? She feels like this is one of the biggest differences that she's noticed among many others with Wisconsin summer weather.
Mm-hmm. That is definitely something that is bound to be true. I can't tell you for sure that I know that's a fact, but I wouldn't be surprised. And the reason why I wouldn't be surprised is that the overnight temperature depends on, in the summertime particularly, how much water vapor there is in the air as the sun goes down. Mm-hmm. And if you've got a lot of water vapor, you can't get below what's called the so-called dew point. And with more water vapor in the air, the dew points are indeed higher, which limits how far down you can go overnight. Exactly correct.
Yep. Yeah, I've noticed that too. It's because I usually like to open the windows at night and let the cool air in, but a lot of times there's not any cool air.
Not recently, yeah. No.
Unfortunately. So hurricane season is here.
Yes. We're a month in.
That's right. What did you guys think about our FEMA director saying he was unaware that there was a hurricane season in the United States?
You know, it's,
you really want to know.
it's so sad, and it doesn't just go with the FEMA director, but some of the leadership that we have now, the ignorance in the field that they're in, and to me, RFK and vaccines is just another example. These are things you need to know.
It's one clown show after another.
Yeah, there's just no reason that FEMA director should not know about the weather hazards, whether they're hurricanes. We also have a heat wave season, and we're hitting it right now, and that's, you know, typically kills 600 people a year. So what, you know, what are they doing? Yeah. They don't know.
It's not an abstract idea, because it really does affect so many people.
Right.
And I think the thing that probably, I know it drives me crazy, and probably John as well, is that, you know, as scientists, we look at the evidence of these things, you know, the evidence that hurricanes hit, you know, particularly, you know, they hit Washington. I mean, they don't get to Wisconsin very often. We get the remnants of it sometimes. But the evidence is there that these things exist, and we've been studying them for a long, long time.
And making steady progress in forecasting them and forecasting where they're going to go and how intense they're going to be when they get there. These are things that are constantly being made better in a normal society. And suddenly when you staff all these agencies with clowns, That really puts the progress at a halt. I mean, today was supposed to be the day that the microwave imager was supposed to go offline.
Oh, right.
And for no reason at all, the government's trying to maybe look nice. It said, we'll extend it for another month so you can have it through the month of July for hurricane season. And this is a great tool for looking at insides of hurricanes overnight. Most nights are about 12 hours long, give or take, in the summertime. And we can't see what's happening to the cloud elements and the convective elements within the storm except with these microwave images. And so for no good reason at all, except to show, as far as I can tell, except to show that we can do it, we're going to say no more of that for this hurricane season.
And hurricane season goes through November.
November 1.
Yeah. So, you know, extending it a month isn't going to really help. And they're doing that with a number of satellites that are really critical to seeing storms, predicting storms, tracking storms, and therefore improving forecasting.
What can that mean to people then?
Well, you know, this isn't directly related to the satellites, but, you know, the other thing that has happened is because of the cuts in the National Weather Service and in NOAA, they're not taking as much observations from the radio sondes that measure the atmospheric profile. And as soon as they stop that, you know, you think, well, okay, you know, let's see what's going to happen. But all of a sudden, forecast of precipitation in southern Wisconsin, you know, there were time periods where, you know, I don't trust it anymore, the three-a-day forecast, because they don't have that observation upwind. And if you don't have that observation upwind, then you can't capture it in your models. And so, you know, it went from, it used to be, you know, in the Biden era, you used that phrase, sorry about that. You know, previously with the National Weather Service forecast, and when they're making those observations, I would be very happy to look at five-day forecasts. It took a while to get there. Hmm. I don't look at them anymore. I mean, it's just you don't have the data upstream to be
accurate. So what does that mean to us, you know, everyday people trying to go about your lives? What is that going to mean to us or could happen?
Can I address the hurricane satellite thing first and then get back to that?
Sure.
Rapid intensification of these hurricanes sometimes occurs right as before they make landfall. Wilma did in 2005. It was one of the strongest storms of all time, and it developed in almost no time at all. I forget the name of the one just two summers ago that was quite like that. And so people are preparing for a Category 1 or a Category 2 storm. They make precautions for that. But if you don't know that a Category 4 storm is on your shoreline when you wake up the next morning, that's a serious problem for you and your evacuation plans and everything else. So that's one thing about the satellites. But the broader question, what does it do for all of us? I think we've all been nurtured in an environment that's increasingly accurate with respect to weather forecasts. We can look at our phone and have confidence that even in the summertime, within you can paint the complexion of the day 5 days out and have some sense of what you might want to do about whatever your schedule might suggest you have to do. Public safety has gotten increasingly more and more guided by weather forecasts. As they get downgraded, everything about public safety and commerce surrounding people's schedules will be degraded as well. And it's inevitably going to cost lives. There's just no question that will be the case. Being able to be certain about this person's life was lost because of this budget cut is going to be an impossible problem. But the general complexion of pulling back on our skills and our abilities for the sake of saving a few dollars will definitely cost lives. It probably already has, but it certainly will. And then hurricane season, it's going to cost a lot more.
Yeah.
Does it look like we're going to have a very active hurricane season this year?
I think the forecast in the spring was for an unusually active, maybe not at the highest level, but that
more
gets
than
updated.
Normal.
Yeah, that gets updated frequently during the season.
Well, we had the first one, right?
Yes, I forget the name of
Andrea.
It. Andrea, that's right, yeah.
Yeah. So they're coming.
They're coming.
We have a season. The season has begun.
They're always coming during that season. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. First of all, if you have a question for the weather guys, we've got open lines here, guys. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can send an email to talk@wpr.com. And Wendy emailed us to say that the discussion of rolling thunder made her think about when we get lightning that is just constant and flashing nonstop for long periods of time. She thinks it was called heat lightning. Her daughter was at the family cabin on the lake when this happened recently, and no one, of course, could sleep. Can you explain what causes this, and also, is it dangerous?
It's less dangerous. I'm going to be obnoxious here. It's less dangerous than lightning when you can hear the thunder.
Yeah, that's true.
Because that means it's closer.
Right.
That's true.
Yeah, heat lightning is, as she was being described, that you can see the lightning in the storm, but you don't hear the thunder. Mm-hmm. The thunder is occurring. It's just propagating away from you. Sometimes the air stream, instead of keeping it along the ground, the thunder sound wave, which is thunder, will travel upward.
Okay.
And sometimes it'll come back down. So it's sometimes you'll have these silent zones where you won't hear the thunder. And then a couple of miles down upwind or downwind, you will hear the thunder.
That's really weird. Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
So the rolling thunder is probably caused by roughly the same thing, except the storms that are generating, in this case, the lightning, you can't hear the thunder, is just closer.
Sure.
So you can hear it, more likely hear it, but it's just not hitting you.
Yeah, so heat lightning, it really isn't a thing that's separate from regular lightning?
Nope, it's just regular lightning.
It's just where you're looking at it.
And it's a great thing to see. I think you typically see it, at least I usually see it in the evening.
And I think it gets its name because it's going to happen at the time of year where you have this heat and humidity we're experiencing right now. It just might not, it's just that the thunderstorm or the line thereof is not on you. It's quite far away.
Okay.
And you see the effects of some of it, the light you can see, you can't hear the sound.
Yeah, excellent.
Now, just to be clear, while I do watch it, I wouldn't recommend taking a metal chair and sitting outside.
Yeah.
Because we do have things called lightning strokes out of the blue. And so you can have a lightning bolt come out of the top of a cloud, and even though it's not raining by you, and it even could be clear, you might get hit by lightning in your area.
You don't want to play with it.
You don't want to play with it. Right.
Well, in related to this, Louise in Dodgeville has a question. Go right ahead, Louise.
Hi, I was talking with my husband last night about thunder, and it's just so common, you don't like think of the physics of it and what's actually happening to create the sound. So I was wondering if you could explain it. And then we've had a lot of really good rain recently, so just wondering what the, if you have an idea if July and August will continue, if you have an early forecast. I think last summer it rained a lot early, and then it got really dry as the summer went on.
That's right. Mm.
Yeah, I'll do the thunder part, and John do the forecast. Okay. But yeah, the thunder is always associated with lightning bolts, or lightning, I should say, always generates thunder. Lightning, I think, is the temperature of that electric discharge is like the temperature of the sun. And it's only a few inches thick, like the fork lightnings that we see as an example. And so the air there gets rapidly heated. And once you heat air, it's going to expand because it's rapidly heated. It expands rapidly. And that's what generates the thunder or basically a sound wave. Mm. And that's why we hear it. And then it reverberates. And so it's sometimes also with the rolling, it'd be hitting buildings and things or other clouds. And so it makes it sound like it's going on for a longer time.
Yeah. And what's the relationship between thunder and lightning as far as how far away is it? Because it's like the lightning strikes and then you count.
Oh, yeah. Forget the rule. Is it something, I think every 7 seconds is a mile or something like that.
Six seconds a mile, I think.
Maybe it's five. Yeah. Somewhere in that range, below 10.
Okay, yeah. I'm sorry. Just wanted to clear that
up. If you only get to 1,000, then you're close.
That's what I always say to myself. If I can count to 2, I don't want to go anywhere outside. Yeah, too scary.
Okay, and go ahead, John.
For the forecast, the last time I looked at the Climate Prediction Center's outlook, and they give a 30 and 60 and a 90-day outlook. I think they have the least confidence of the whole year they have in the summertime because the nature of the storms that bring you rain are very short life cycles. They might live a couple of hours maximum, sometimes as much as 12 or 24, but they're not organized as often as they are in the cold season with migrating storms that you can track across the country for 4 or 5 days. And so I think the last time I looked, I think we were looking at about a 50% probability of just as wet or wetter than normal. So that pretty much means they can't make any discernment about what's coming in the next couple of months. Although the call is right, last May and June, especially in southern Wisconsin, very wet, and then suddenly flipped over entirely and was dry the rest of the summer. So, you know, that's probably more like the kind of summer that you usually get. You don't usually get 3 straight months of heavy rain during the summertime. So I guess if I had to make my own forecast, I'd bias it toward drying out as we go through July and August. When exactly, I don't know.
Okay, great. I guess I'm going to have to start watering more.
Yeah, I know. You know, that's right. You have to do that.
Thanks, Louise. Appreciate it. Gary in the town of Ween, go right ahead.
Thank you for your great show. I'm a listener all the time. And thank you to your two guests for speaking the truth. It is so frustrating. I've been following the issue of a warming climate since Dr. Hansen, I believe his name was, spoke to the Senate and talked about it. And then I have just personal observations and reading articles trying to understand it. I think if your guests know anything about the old Know-Nothing Party in the United States, well, we have the new Know-Nothing Party, and they're making these decisions based on ignorance or indifference. My favorite T-shirt I have says science, because figuring things out is better than making stuff up.
That's right. It's more fun, too.
That's right.
It's very easy to make things up.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Gary. Appreciate those kind words. Glenn in Glen Arbor, Michigan, go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I heard the earlier caller's story about the water spout on one of the inland lakes, and I was thinking about the behavior of the things. I've watched a few come and go, and the amount of water they pick up, you know, you've got this column of, it's not spinning air or 2x4s. It's just water, but the mass that thing is picking up, you know, the way that they shut down and the ones that I saw were kind of straw-shaped, actually, really wild-looking.
And they're composed of droplets, which also I find really interesting. I don't know what the size of those droplets are or what the distribution of sizes
is. That's interesting. Yeah, I wonder what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's probably less water mass than it looks because, you know, when there's a bunch of droplets, they're going to scatter the light and everything looks white. It's like a white tornado, so you can't see through it, and you don't know how much there is. The really big ones, though, can pick up fish, I've heard.
Oh, right.
And deposit them somewhere else. Yeah. So they're stronger vortices, I assume, to be able to do that. The ones on the inland lakes may be a little bit weaker than that, but no less dramatic to see, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Are these ever big enough to be caught on a satellite imaging?
I don't know about that. I kind of would doubt it. I
don't think, because I think eventually they have to get coupled with a storm, a thunderstorm. And it's probably not a severe thunderstorm, so you won't have the overshooting tops, so you probably wouldn't be able to identify them. They can get picked up on radar, though.
Okay.
Ground-based radar.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks, Glenn. Great. Appreciate that question. Next up is Eric in Portage. Go right ahead, Eric.
Hi. I was wondering what you could tell me about ball lightning. In 2015, I was working in central Iowa, and I seen like a ball of electricity go right across, horizontally across in front of me.
Man. You know, that's a really interesting phenomena. I don't think they've figured it out yet, what actually causes it. But it's sort of like what you're describing. It's just a ball of lightning, a lit up ball that just floats around.
Goes through keyholes, I've heard, and stuff like this.
It just goes through walls and things. So it's not, that's what I mean. I think a lot of people, lightning experts are still trying to figure out what actually causes it.
I think it's wizards.
Yeah, Harry Potter lightning or something.
Right.
Thank you, Eric. We appreciate that. With us today are John Martin, professor and former chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison, and Steve Ackerman, an emeritus professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences. Please give us a call if you have a question for them, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about the new book, Baseball Like It Ought to Be. It's about the history of the Madison Mallards. And then we're going to talk about disc golf and competitive water skiing. That's all tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show. Looking forward to that. I'm sure Larry should be back by then. But right now, we are talking about the weather. Our lines are full, so let's go right over there to Virginia in Madison. Go right ahead.
Hello. I live in Madison and grew up here. I'm not widely traveled, but I now have a neighbor who lived in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. She tells me there's quite a difference between the clouds here and the clouds in Pennsylvania. What would make that happen?
I think Bucks County's got some of the Appalachians in it, I think. There might be some mountain clouds that are different. We don't see them around here very much, and they look like this sort of flying saucer. They're called lenticular clouds. You can sometimes see those in places probably like Bucks County.
Probably lee wave clouds, too.
Yeah, lee waves off the mountains. So there might be
rows of clouds.
Some of the differences might come from the category of just being closer to higher terrain. But I don't know about any other differences besides that.
The only difference I can think of is that if they're in a mountainous region, they're not going to have that open sky
that we have
down here. I mean, it's not as open as Colorado where we used to live, but you could see more of the sky, and so you're probably seeing cloud structures that look differently.
Along those lines, you know, when you see a giant cumulonimbus in the summertime in a place with a broad open sky, it looks different. It looks more impressive than it does when you see just a fraction of it. If it's
you can see the whole structure with the anvil and
So some of the differences may not actually be differences, just differences in perception. But there may also be some real differences. Yeah. So that's interesting.
Yeah, I've noticed that now I lived in the UP for, you know, when I was growing up, and the sky down here is definitely different feeling looking. I could pick out a Wisconsin summer sky out of a bunch of pictures. I'm not sure what it is about it. The clouds just seem taller. The blue sky is bluer. I don't really know what the difference is, but I understand what they're kind of saying. Yeah. So
Well, we've had this long-standing little theory we wanted to try out, one of my colleagues and I. If you could take out the foliage when you look at the horizon,
sure.
and then just say, what time of year does this sky look like? Most people have a sense of that.
Oh, yeah.
I think they would have a lot of congruence in people's answers.
Oh, definitely.
You know? So we pay attention to it subconsciously, some of us consciously, some both, more than we probably think we do.
Yeah.
It's really interesting.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know if it's because I have art background, because I notice light a lot. Mm. But yeah, you can always tell. It's like once in a while in the fall, you're like, oh, that's like a summer light day.
Yeah, isn't it? Right? Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay. Or the other way around sometimes. Yeah.
Yep. Steve, you'll just have to start observing more.
You know, I look a lot, but
it's just too stuck on this retirement.
Apparently. Well, speaking of Colorado, we have Dean in Evergreen on the line. Go right ahead, Dean.
Hi, and hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I had career in meteorology and 40 some plus years and retired a while ago. I was wondering, as I look back on my travels, what do you guys see as future developments? Where's the frontier in meteorology? Let me put it that way.
Boy, that's a good question. I guess I would have to look at the polar regions, the changes that are occurring because of global warming induced by greenhouse gases that humans eject. As those glaciers, snow fields go away, what's going to happen to the weather patterns? Because they will affect, terrain as well. When the Greenland ice sheet, this is many years from now, but when that evaporates and goes away, you know, that landmass that underneath is going to come up. And how high is that going to be? And how's that going to affect the ocean circulations?
Yeah, for different reasons. I think I'd agree with Steve if I had to put one thing down on the table. It would be understanding the interaction between the polar latitudes and the extratropical latitudes better than we do right now. We've recently discovered that there are some, especially in the cold season, but not exclusively in the cold season, there are these things called tropopause polar vortices that are formed by cooling at cloud top in the Arctic, and they can last all winter long, these little vortices that go around the whole hemisphere several times before they finally dissipate. Sometimes they dissipate because the sun comes back up. Sometimes they get ejected into the middle latitudes and contribute to developments there. But we don't really understand that set of vortices very well, nor its interactions with the middle latitudes, particularly, as I say, in the cold season. And I think it has something to do or it contributes to forecast inaccuracy, periods where we can't really trust the forecast in the winter. And so I'd say that's one place, sort of a foundational level of new understanding that might be developed in the next 20 or so years that could have a lot of implications for short-term forecast accuracy.
Do you think that affects mid-latitude cyclones?
Yes, definitely it does.
Wow.
We just don't know exactly how in a systematic way.
Huh.
And I think it affects the transition from the winter to the spring, because not every spring in the Northern Hemisphere is the same. Some are really stormy and some are very placid. And I think it has to do with the supply of those beasts.
Wow.
At the high latitudes in the wintertime.
Wow, interesting. Yeah. Dean, thank you so much for spurring this great conversation. Let's go to Jan in Madison next. Go right ahead, Jan.
Hi. My question is probably unanswerable, but I'm going to ask it anyway. If we were to, say, by 2030, stop the growth in worldwide temperature, how long would it take to reverse that trend and get us back to where we were, say, 150 years ago? And I'm thinking, how many centuries would that be?
Yeah.
It's an answerable question, because I think we looked at that in the 90s, early 2000s. Mm-hmm. You know, if you were to stop greenhouse gas emissions, how long? So running climate models is what you would do. How long would it take to get back to what we were, you know, in the 1950s?
I would guess it's more than a century, because it's the residence time of carbon dioxide molecule in the atmosphere is somewhere between 50 and 100 years, we think. Same with methane. And so if you put it in there in an artificial way, that is from burning fossil fuels, it takes that long for it to come out. And so all of the excess that we've contributed over the last 100-plus years is going to take some time to rain out. of the atmosphere. And I don't mean that it'll come out in rain, but just to come out of the atmosphere. And so if we stop adding more right now, it seems to me it takes us about 100 years to get rid of all that excess. And having a, you know, 5-year turnaround time to absolutely stop adding new carbon dioxide to the atmosphere is probably overly optimistic. So it's going to be longer than that even. But we maybe don't have to get back to 1850. I mean, that's right, another thing to keep in mind. We maybe don't have to get all the way back there. The carbon dioxide fraction was around 320 parts per million in 1958 when we started taking observations every day on the top of Mauna Loa in Hawaii. If we could get back there, which is way above what it was in 1850, we'd probably still be making a big dent in all of the climate change.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much, Jan. So we want to kind of try to end each of our episodes with you both with a new weather term.
Oh.
Because there's so many unusual weather terms out there. So the one that we picked out was seiche. Hmm. Are you familiar with it? And for those who aren't, it's spelled S-E-I-C-H-E. And between the June 20th and the 22nd, it occurred on Lake Superior. Hmm. What is it and what caused it?
It's a fascinating thing because it occurs a lot on Lake Erie. And I went to school upstate New York, and so was aware of it. But what it is, you have a strong wind, steady strong wind over a lake. And so you can imagine water moves. If it's steady from the same direction, it'll push all that water on one side of the lake. And so on, and this, we just saw this, as you're saying, in June in Lake Superior. So along the shoreline where the wind is hitting the shoreline and then pushing the water away, all of a sudden the water level will drop and in some cases just go and be bare, bare ground or bare shoreline. And then eventually the storm system moves on. And once that happens, all that water that's piled up on the other shoreline comes sloshing back. And that can slosh back a couple of times, depending on what the lake is.
And
you get it a lot in Lake Erie because I think you could observe it a lot. One, because it's shallower, but then also the orientation and the shape of the lake also seems to encourage seiches to occur.
I'd guess they're more rare on Superior because it's so deep.
Yeah,
but maybe if you've got inlets on the coast or something that are maybe funnel shaped or something, you would have.
And this was
some
in a bay,
effects.
Right?
I don't know the exact.
I'm not going to try and pronounce
Chemakwikin Bay or whatever it is.
That's
that's a great name.
Bay.
So, does that cause problems with shipping and boating and things like that when that happens, or is it just kind of a subtle thing?
I think, definitely for boating, kayakers, and things like that. I think in many of the shipping lanes, they're going to be deep enough that probably not as much of an issue.
Yeah,
it's pretty rare, like you said, unless you're on Erie, where it's a little
shallower lakes. It isn't so.
I had never heard of it before. So
I only heard about it through affiliation with this program, but it was many years ago, and Steve knew it right off the top of his head.
Okay. Wow, interesting. Well, I didn't know we were repeating ourselves, but excellent.
We've been on air since a long time.
So if anybody has a term that they would like the guys to define, please send it to us. You can send an email to talk@wpr.org. So we've got Roger in DeForest who has a story about a tornado. Roger, we need to make it short. Go ahead.
Yeah, short story. Douglas, Vilas County, we vacationed up there every year because my mother had allergies to hay fever, ragweed pollen. My dad would come up for a week. He had 2 weeks vacation, and we went on a little 11-foot resorter boat, aluminum boat, on Tower Lake in northern Vilas County. And it got dark and all of a sudden real still, and then we could hear something like a freight train, and we were sitting in the boat fishing, and a small tornado funnel cloud came across the top of the Popples and Aspen, went over the top of us, went down into the lake and started sucking up water, tons and tons of water being sucked up into this vortex. And all of a sudden it got so heavy with all the water that it all blew apart. And the little tornado, the mini tornado, just went down in branches the size of your leg, leaves, tons of leaves and weeds and water came down into the lake. And my dad was scared
All right. Well, thank you, Roger.
Pretty awesome.
We need to make that short.
I would be scared too.
Yeah, I would be too. Thank you, Steve and John. We really appreciate our weather guys being with us today. Thank you also to our team members, Clara Neipert, Joel Patenaude, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Roberts, and of course, Larry Mueller. I'm executive producer Jill Nadeau. Thanks for being with us, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.